You're listening to the weekly broadcast of Grace Church, an independent Bible teaching church in Wichita Falls, Texas. Each week, our Sunday morning teaching is presented by one of a team of pastors as we journey together through a book of the Bible, theological study, or life-related topic. Thanks for tuning in. Here's this week's message.
When Sam and I were early in our dating relationship, it came to that moment in the relationship where I wanted to tell her that I loved her for the very first time. But I was pretty nervous about it because up until that point, we hadn't exactly been on the same page in our relationship. See, early on, I knew this was the woman that I wanted to marry, that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her. And at the same time, I would later learn she was trying to figure out how she could break up with me. I wasn't great at reading the room, right? And so I'm nervous, and this comes to this point, like I love her and I want to tell her this. And so we're at our house and we're watching a movie, and I'm so nervous, and it takes me like 30 minutes to build up the courage to actually say the words. And I finally do, and I kind of just stutter them out, you know, because I'm so worried. And I'm like, Sam, I love you. And then it feels like an eternity of silence. It's probably all of 2 seconds. And then she looks back at me, their big, beautiful eyes, and she says, "What?" So now I'm at this moment, this pivotal moment of choice, because I couldn't read the tone of that "what." I wasn't sure if that's a "what on earth did you just say to me? I'm done with you," or "I can't hear you, could you repeat yourself?" And so I'm sitting here thinking, okay, what do I do? Do I say it again and risk complete embarrassment and have no ability to recover? Or do I just pretend like nothing ever happened and I just be like, "Oh, nothing, just cough, nothing, I like the movie. What do you think?" And so I stepped out on the ledge, stepped off, and I'm like, "I said I love you." Just hoping. She's like, "Oh, I love you too. I just couldn't hear you." And I was like, "Oh, good, good." And here we are, all these years later, things worked out for us. Maybe you've had moments like that where you've come to a choice, you've come to a moment, and you could tell in the moment that this was a big decision, a big choice, and it felt like the weight of everything was on your shoulders, and everything led to this moment, and you have to choose, and you're knowing it's going to set the course for your life. We've had these pivotal moments of our life. Maybe it's when you're in high school trying to decide what you're going to do after school. Am I going to go to college, or am I going to go to learn a trade, or I'm going to take a gap year? And maybe if I'm going to college, what college am I going to go to? Maybe it's a career. Maybe you've moved your family across the country for a job and you were wondering, is this the right decision? Maybe it's family. Maybe it's kids. Maybe it's something else. Or maybe for you, you could look back on your story and you could think of so many small moments that seemed insignificant at the time. You made a choice, not even thinking about what might come from it, but looking back, you can see how one small decision led you down a path that to where you are today. All of these decisions that we make through the course of our lives can actually help us grow and deepen and strengthen our faith. That our mission as a church is we want to develop maturing followers of Jesus Christ. To say it even more simply, we want our faith in Jesus to grow. We want our faith to be deeper, stronger, more resilient. We want more and more dependency upon Jesus. And so how does our faith grow? It grows in so many different ways, but this morning we're going to look at one particular way. It's pivotal moments of choice. That when we're faced with a decision to trust God or not, that when we can say yes to what God is asking us to do, we will see that it strengthens and grows our faith. And we're going to look at this idea through the book of Esther and the story of faith of Esther and Mordecai. So I invite you to open your copy of Scripture to Esther chapter 1. This is a long story. It's full of ups and downs and twists and turns. I would encourage you to read the whole book on your own sometime this week. It's an excellent story. And so what we're going to do is we're going to spend some time in the introduction looking at chapter 1. Then we're going to go over to chapters 3 and 4, spend most of our time there this morning. And then we'll kind of give an overview and end with chapters 8 and 9. The book of Esther is fascinating for a few reasons. One, God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. And maybe you're like me and you're thinking, well, that can't be right. It's in the Bible. If it's a book of the Bible, it has to talk about God, right? But not in Esther. The book of Esther never mentions God throughout the entire story. And it's intentional by the author. And what the author is trying to communicate through that is that even when God feels absent, even when God feels like he's not there or it feels like he's not working, that God is always at work. And so this book is crafted in such a way that as the reader, you see God's movement throughout the story. You see him bringing all of these things together, even though he's never explicitly mentioned. And this is why reflecting on your own story is so important. Because we can go through life never thinking about our own story and never being aware of how God has worked in our lives to bring us to today. But as we reflect and go back and think about our own story, we can begin to connect dots of God's faithfulness all along the way. The book of Esther is also fascinating because Esther and Mordecai, the heroes we're going to look at this morning, is that they live in a morally ambiguous place. That they aren't following the law. The law is never even mentioned. And the book is set after the Jewish return to Jerusalem from their exile, the return that Esther and Mordecai and many other Jews chose not to participate in. The heroes of our story never talk explicitly to God. They never even explicitly pray. We see them fast, we see them mourn, we'll see them lament, but they never directly lament to God. They never directly speak to God. They plot and they scheme on their own. They break laws of the Torah. They aren't prescriptive models of how we are to act, but what they are is a descriptive model of trust and hope, even when life seems hopeless. We'll see that Esther and Mordecai throughout this story, that even when God feels absent, he's always working. And even when he's working, Esther and Mordecai model trust and hope when life feels hopeless. So now let's turn our attention to chapter 1 of Esther. We're going to pick up in verse 17. We're going to read about the king of Persia, King Ahasuerus. And King Ahasuerus is also known as King Xerxes, the Persian name that you might be more familiar with. And he's had a party. He's thrown this giant elaborate party and things get wild. They get out of hand and he wants to show off. And so he calls for his wife, Queen Vashti, to be brought in so that her beauty can be shown off. And he just wants to use her to show off to everyone there. And she refuses. He's outraged. His officials and princes are outraged and they're worried what it's going to mean for them. And so we pick up in verse 17 with them coming to the king with this advice. Verse 17, it says, "For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, 'King Ahasuerus has commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come.' This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath and plenty. So if it please the king, let a royal order go out for him. Let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she." So the king says, "Yeah, this is a good idea. We have to teach her a lesson. I'm going to depose her, and then I'm going to try to find a new queen. And so we're going to have essentially a royal beauty pageant. And we're going to look for all of the most beautiful women in the land, and I'm going to bring them into my harem to make them my concubines, and then we're going to select one to be the queen." And this is where we meet Esther and Mordecai in our story. Mordecai, Esther's uncle, and he had taken Esther in because her parents had already passed away. And so Esther is brought before the king because of her beauty, and her beauty captivates the king, and she's eventually selected to be queen, elevated to this position of queen. And Mordecai along the way is giving her advice saying, you've reached this level, but don't let them know your story. Don't let them know your heritage. Don't let them know that you are a Jew. And so we see this amazing rise of Esther into this position of the queen. And yet it's amazing, and there's this tension of she's living in this reality now where, yes, it's good to be queen. And at the other hand, it's you live in fear and worry. What if I'm the next Queen Vashti? What if I'm the next one that's thrown out? What if I am just used by the king who seems to just do things with no reason, living in this corrupt and oppressive system? She's living in this tension. And around the same time, we discover that Mordecai hears of an assassination plot against the king. And so he warns the king through Esther. And so Esther gets to come to the king and say, there's this assassination plot, and Mordecai's the one who warned us about it. And Mordecai's expecting to be elevated or rewarded, and yet he's never acknowledged, never given credit for what he's done. Later, we see the king promote an official named Haman, and Haman will become crucial to our story. The king, when he elevates Haman, commands all of his officials to bow down and give honor to Haman, but Mordecai refuses. And Haman is outraged by this act of disrespect. And he's outraged not just at Mordecai, but he's also learned that Mordecai is Jewish. And so his anger turns just from Mordecai onto the entire Jewish community. And so he goes before the king and he says, these Jews, they follow their own rules. They don't follow your rules and they're a problem. And so we need to deal with this problem and I have an idea. So I invite you now to turn to chapter 3, verse 12. Of Esther. And we're going to spend our time walking through the end of chapter 3 and into chapter 4. So Haman has gone to the king and he says, I have this plan to get rid of the Jews, this problem that you have. And we pick up in verse 12. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to all the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language, so that they cannot miss it, everyone in their own language. And it was written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. And a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. That Haman, elevated to second in command, is given the signet ring of the king, representing all of his power and his authority to send out instructions to the people that they're ruling. Mirrors, thinking back to last week, it mirrors Joseph's story where Joseph is elevated to second in command and given the signet ring of Pharaoh. But Joseph elevated that position in order to save God's people. This week, Haman has schemed his way into this position in order to destroy God's people. The king, easily influenced, seemingly with no moral guide or compass, agrees to this plan, not knowing that his own queen would fall under this judgment. It's easy to read past this. It's easy to read this as history. But I want to invite us to slow down and feel the weight of what's happening here. To destroy, to kill, to annihilate all of the Jews in the entire kingdom. Imagine what it would feel like if everyone's phone started going off in this moment with Twitter updates and breaking news that the vice president has issued an executive order to every governor of every state, to every mayor of every city, that at the end of the year that they are to use their full force to kill, annihilate all Christians, young and old, women and children, and to plunder all of their wealth. And not only that, you'll be paid very well to do so. What do you think you'd be feeling in that moment as a follower of Jesus? Fear, worry, anxiety, anger. I think I'd be asking the question, God, what are you doing? God, where are you? God, why are you letting this happen? Why are you letting this happen at all? But why are you letting this happen to your people? God, what are you doing? Why? And I imagine that was what Mordecai was feeling as well. Let's continue reading in chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. And he cried out with a loud and bitter cry, and he went up to the entrance of the king's gate. For no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. We might not clothe ourselves in sackcloth and ashes, but I can imagine we would feel very similar to this. We would cry out with a loud and bitter cry. We would mourn. We would weep. And it says they lamented. We would lament. But that's not a phrase we use often in our modern Christian vocabulary, but it's found often in Scripture. There are entire psalms of lament. There's an entire book of lament in the Bible called the Book of Lamentations that's just filled with laments to God. So what is lament? Mark Vrogrop says it this way, that lament is the honest cry of a hurting heart wrestling with the paradox of pain and the promise of God's goodness. The honest cry of a hurting heart that's wrestling with this paradox of pain on the one side and the promises of God on the other. That lament is this realization that the world is broken and we're coming to God honestly because we're hurting and we're confused and we're worried and we're saying, God, where are you? Why is this happening? I don't understand. Why could you let this happen on one side? With on the other side saying, God, I believe in you and I trust that you're good and I trust your character and I trust that you love me and I want to believe that you can work all things together for good and yet I don't see it right now and you're living in the in-between. It's lament. We get a picture of this throughout the Psalms. An example in Psalm 6 is a psalm of David where he cries out and he says, I am weary with my moaning. Every night I flood my bed with tears. I drench my couch with my weeping. My eye wastes away because of grief. It grows weak because of all my foes. Depart from me, all you workers of evil. You feel it? Every night, I'm flooding my bed with my tears. My eyes are wasting away because of my grief. Every night and every day and on and on and on it goes. And my enemies, they won't stop. He's crying out to the God. But then verse 8, he says, but the Lord has heard the sound of my weeping. The Lord has heard my plea. The Lord accepts my prayer. And David, living in that tension, he's saying, every day and night I'm crying out to God and I'm weeping, and he's not fixing it. He's not changing something immediately. It's not, I cried out once and things changed, and yet I'm still trusting that he heard me, that he's with me, and that he's working. Lament gives us the permission and freedom to live in this paradox. This paradox of the world is broken, and yet I have trust in my God who is good. That lament doesn't show a lack of faith, it reveals our faith. Because if we've already written God off as someone who is ambivalent or doesn't exist or won't work in our lives, if we've written God off as someone who is unfaithful, then we won't bother with lament. We won't step into that because we won't think that he can move. And so our doubt in the moment, but our turning to God with our doubts shows that we have faith. We want to believe in a God who is good and just. And so we see Mordecai and all of the Jews lamenting that faith does not preclude this type of response from trials. That you don't have to pretend that everything is okay when it isn't. That you don't have to fake it. It's going to be okay when it doesn't feel that way. You can have both pain and promise at the same time. It means you're living in the tension of this broken world with a God who has promised to restore all things one day. And so Esther, she hears about this lamenting and she hears about this mourning and she is deeply distressed. And so she sends an attendant out to Mordecai saying, Mordecai, here, change out of your sackcloth, put on normal clothes. That way you can come into the king's court and you can come talk to me. But he refuses. And so he sends a message back to Esther and he says, Esther, you must do something. You're the queen. Go talk to the king. Let's end this. Let's fix this. Let's solve this. And she says, I can't. Yes, I'm the queen, But I haven't been invited to come before the king. And even as the queen, if I show up unannounced, I could be killed. I can't do anything about it. And then we read about Mordecai's response in chapter 4, verse 12. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. And then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther. Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. This is Mordecai's moment of faith. It is on full display here. Mordecai, not the picture of the perfect life, not the perfect moral example, but here the model of trust and hope, even when things seem hopeless. Hope in the middle of his sorrow and his grief and his lamenting. He comes to Esther and he says, Esther, first, don't think that just because you're the queen, you will be spared. You will fall under this judgment as well. And then his incredible faith. But if you keep silent, Esther, if you don't do anything, relief and deliverance will come from another place. That I am so confident in who my God is and his promises to his people that even if you don't stand up and do something, I trust that God is going to deliver us some other way. I have no idea how. I don't see it. I don't understand it. And I'm in the middle of this grief and this lament, and I'm feeling all of these things, and yet I still trust that God is going to deliver us. Then he turns to her and he says, who knows? Who knows? Maybe God has placed you in this position at this time and at this place for this very reason, for such a time as this. He's saying, who knows? I don't know God's exact plan, Esther. I can't see the future. I don't have it all figured out. I can't see the next move. And I trust that God is going to save us. And who knows? Maybe all the twists and turns of your own life, of your parents' death, of me bringing you in, of getting into the kingdom through this beauty pageant, through the corruption, through all of these things, it has been God working in your life to bring you to this exact moment for such a time as this. And so, Esther, what are you going to do? And we're at this pivotal moment in Esther's story where she has a choice. God has been working all along the way to bring her to this moment, and she has the choice, will I trust God or not? Will I trust him even when it feels impossible? Will I trust him even if it might cost me something? Will I trust him even when I don't see or understand what he's doing? Will I step off the ledge in faith? And we see Esther's incredible response in verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go. Gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. And Mordecai went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. If I perish, I perish. What a model of faith. She's saying, let's prepare. Let's do our part. We're going to fast together before this. We're going to prepare. But then I'm going to take a step of faith. And I'm going to go before the king, even if it's against the law, and even if it means I'm put to death, or even if it means I'm wrong, that God's going to use me to deliver his people. I might be missing it. I might be wrong, but I'm going to trust and obey. And if it costs me, it costs me. Esther in this moment has no idea what hangs in the balance of this decision to trust. She can't see the future. She doesn't have the rest of the book written for her. She doesn't know what's going to happen when she walks in to speak with the king. And I'm tempted to just leave us here with a cliffhanger so you have to go home and read the story on your own. And I'm tempted to do that because I also don't want us to rush past this moment of faith. Because in our own lives, when we're faced with moments of choice on trusting God or not, it's not an immediate sense of trust and then everything's better. There's that period of waiting where I feel like I've stepped out in faith and I don't know what's going to happen. Or maybe things don't get better immediately. And I'm imagining Esther for 3 days fasting, thinking about what she has to do, thinking about coming before the king and preparing and wondering, am I walking into my death? What am I going to do? And feeling all of that. And then still at the end of that, saying, I'm going to step in and I'm going to trust. And if I perish, I perish. But as much as this is a story of Esther and Mordecai's faith, it is also a story of God's faithfulness. So I invite you now to turn to chapter 8. And as you're turning, I'm going to catch us up on what happens in between. So Esther does come before the king, and that God works to bless Esther's courage and faith and to stop Haman's plot. And God works to do that even still without being mentioned, reminding us, the reader, that he's always at work even when we can't see it. And there's drama and there's intrigue into how this stopping this plot has to happen, and it's far from a simple solution. Go read it on your own. It's great. But we see Haman's plotting and scheming and his rise to the top to annihilate and destroy God's people ends up being completely reversed. That instead of him destroying God's people destroy him and his family. His arrogance and pride that led him to the top, his cunning has failed him, and we see his downfall. And we see Mordecai, the one who had saved the king, but never received credit, never received acknowledgement. We see finally his deliverance come as well, and he is elevated in Haman's place. Esther chapter 8, verse 1 says, on that day, the king gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her, that they were family. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and he gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. We see God working through all of Esther and Mordecai's life to be faithful to his promise to provide and care for his people. And we see Esther and Mordecai getting to play a part in the story that God was telling, even if in the moment they had no idea what hung in the balance of their faith. I invite us now to turn to chapter 9. We're going to pick up in verse 20. We see that Mordecai begins writing all of these things down. And Mordecai, in his new position, he institutes a holiday for all of the Jewish people, this celebration holiday, that the people might remember God's faithfulness to them. We see this in chapter 9, verse 20. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of the king, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. He institutes a holiday so that the people would remember. Because I think Mordecai understood what is so true about us in human nature is that it's so easy to forget. It's so easy to forget God's previous provision in our lives. He's saying we need to remember that God has turned our sorrow into gladness. He's turned our mourning into this celebration, and we couldn't have seen it coming. So we need to remember as a people God's faithfulness in our story. We need to look back and see how God was faithful then so that he can be faithful now. And so the moment we step into another season of mourning or doubt or confusion or pain, we can look back and we can remember God was there then and he's there with me now. We need to remember. Mordecai understood how easy it is to forget. The moment something challenging comes, the moment a problem happens and we begin to spiral down this path of worry and fear and what's going to happen and what are you doing, God, and I don't understand, let's remember. Let's remember what he's done.
It's why we're walking through these stories all summer. It's why we're going to encourage you to keep reflecting on your own story. Because you and I, we will likely never be in the same situation as Mordecai and Esther. We probably won't have the extinction of an entire people on the shoulders of one decision that we're going to make. But each of us every day have decisions that impact the course of our lives and impact the course of our faith. That we as followers of Jesus are invited to be led by the Holy Spirit, to walk by the Spirit, step by step, moment by moment, choosing to trust in the big moments and in the small. If you're here this morning and you've never made the ultimate choice to trust in Jesus, I'd like to invite you to do that this morning. But the story of the God that we're reading about here continues on throughout Scripture, and it's pointing us forward to Jesus Christ. The Scripture tells us that you and I, we have been separated, alienated from God by our own choices, by our own sin, our own rebellion, our own brokenness. But that God, in His love and His mercy and His grace, wants to bring us back into relationship with Him. He wants to offer us life, abundant, meaningful, purposeful life here and now and for all of eternity. And so He sent His Son Jesus to live the perfect life that you and I could never live, to die on a cross, to pay the price of sin that you and I deserve, that price is death, in order that on the third day He might be raised from life, in order to offer you and I new life in His name as we celebrated with baptisms. Baptism symbolizing the death of Jesus as people go under the water. It's like they're joining Christ in His death, but then they're raised up out of that water like Christ was raised from the grave, and they're raised to this new life, this life everlasting that begins today and continues on forever. And it's a life full of meaning and purpose and joy. And the way we access that life, it's not by our works, it's not by our effort, it's not by our striving, it's by trust. It's by faith in Jesus. And so maybe you're here this morning and you are faced with that choice. Will I trust Jesus or not? I would encourage you to place your trust, your faith in Him this morning. And often, for those of us who are followers of Jesus, the pivotal moments of our life, they might be an occasional big moment, but so often they're the everyday moments of faith. The everyday moments of faith as we're led by the Spirit. Maybe for you, it's the Spirit leading you to text a friend to get a cup of coffee because you know they need encouragement. And maybe you're wondering, what are they going to think? Or maybe I don't have the words, or maybe I don't know what to say. Will you trust that God can work through you by His Spirit that indwells you? Maybe God is leading you today to forgive someone who has hurt you. Will you trust that God is a God of justice and He can take care of you? Will you trust that you can find freedom from the anger and the bitterness maybe that you've been carrying for years? In that act of trust, maybe you need to go to someone and ask for their forgiveness. Maybe you're worried they'll reject you or they won't hear you, and maybe they will. Can you have faith like Esther to say, if I perish, I perish? Maybe you're not going to die, but maybe it feels like it, to risk being vulnerable, to acknowledge maybe that you were wrong and to ask for someone's forgiveness, and it feels like you're giving them something of you, and you're like, if I perish, I perish, but I'm going to trust that God's with me. Maybe the step of faith for you this morning isn't actually a step forward, it's just waiting. Maybe God's asking you to wait on His timing for something. Can you trust that He is working and that you don't need to take matters into your own hands? Maybe you feel led to start serving in the church, but you're wondering if you have what it takes. Will you trust that God has equipped you by His Spirit to be a part of the story that He's writing right here at Grace Church? Maybe you're here this morning and you're just angry. You're angry at God. You're mad at Him. You're hurt by Him. And you wouldn't admit it at church because you feel like you have to put on the smile and pretend that everything's okay. Maybe the invitation for you this morning is an invitation to lament. The invitation is to trust that God is safe, to bring all of your doubts and anger and pain honestly before him, and trust that he can handle that. For those of us who are followers of Jesus, every day is an opportunity to say yes to where the Spirit is leading us. Every day is an opportunity to say yes, that maybe in all of the circumstances of my life and all of the ways that God has been working that I can see and that I can't see, that he's led me to this moment for such a time as this. And maybe you're dismissing me because you feel like, yeah, I'm not Esther and I'm not saving the entire people group. Maybe not, but maybe God has led you to this moment to say yes today, and maybe it feels insignificant and small to you, but maybe we have no idea what hangs in the balance of our trust. And what happens as we say yes to the invitation of God to trust is our faith will grow, because we'll step out on that ledge and we'll take a step and we'll feel like we're falling, and yet we'll see that God is faithful and our faith grows. And so then we can take maybe another step and risk again, and we can see that God is faithful and our faith grows. And so then we can take another step and we see that God is faithful and our faith grows. And so as we continue to say yes, we get more and more opportunities to say yes. Our faith will continue to grow so that we begin to see our lives as every day is an opportunity to join God in the story that he's telling right here in Wichita Falls, right here in the lives of the people in your circles, in your family, in your friendships, in your neighborhood, that God is working here and now. And who knows? Knows, maybe he's brought you here for such a time as this. And so as we close, I want to leave you with two questions to consider as we think about this life of faith and our stories of faith. One is, when is a specific time that God has been faithful to you? And maybe you're thinking, like, God's always been faithful. Reflect back on your own story. When is a specific time that maybe you had to take that step of faith and you didn't know what was going to happen, but looking back, you can see how God was faithful to provide. And maybe you're hearing going, I don't have a clue. I can't think of anything. Maybe that's just a prayer you can begin praying this week. God, show me. Show me in my story how you've been faithful. Remind me. Help me to remember your faithfulness. And the second question, how is God asking you to take a step of faith today? Where is he asking you to trust him today?
You've been listening to the weekly broadcast of Grace Church, an independent Bible teaching church in Wichita Falls, Texas. You can join us Sunday mornings for worship at our campus on Stone Lake Drive in Wichita Falls. Stream services live online at gracechurch.com. Or subscribe to our podcast, published on Apple and Spotify. From all of us at Grace Church, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.